current state on 90.5 WKAR. We come your way three times daily, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM, and at noon every day on AM 870. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thursday has arrived. We're at the middle of August already. Later this hour, we learn more about Michigan's obesity problem. We rank very highly nationally. We have for years in terms of obesity and overweight citizens. It comes at a substantial cost in all kinds of ways, a monetary cost, a health cost. And the Citizens Research Council's Nicole Bradshaw joins us in just a little bit. CRC is an independent, nonpartisan research organization that helps us out once a month, getting a better handle on important policy issues here that are, that face the state of Michigan. And Nicole joins us in just a little bit to help us sort out this very thorny, very complicated problem. Also, later this hour, we'll learn more about E.L. Doctorow's new novel, Andrew's Brain. Scott Southard, our book reviewer, returns here on WKAR's Current State. To start out our program, longtime fans of the Detroit Tigers cling to their memories of Tiger Stadium. Many still visit the old site at Michigan and Trumbull in the Motor City to stand on that hallowed ground or run the base paths. Detroit has another historic baseball site worth visiting, though, and Current State Scott Pohl spent some time there recently. It was his latest talk with Jack Dempsey of the Michigan Historical Commission. It's actually surrounded by the city of Detroit, not in the city. Here is their conversation at Hamtramck Stadium, once home to the Detroit Stars of baseball's Negro Leagues. The site gets a long overdue historical marker today.
We're at Hamtramck Stadium, which, as a baseball fan, I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know existed until you brought it to my attention, Jack. This is where the Detroit Stars of the Negro Baseball Leagues played a lot of their games. I understand they played at more than one location historically, but they played a majority of their games here. And what's fascinating is that, considering its role in history, the grandstands are still here. They used to seat thousands of people here for Negro Leagues baseball.
Correct. 9,000 fans attended the opening of this ballpark in May of 1930, and Ty Cobb threw out the first pitch
at a Negro Leagues baseball game,
which kind of may surprise some people.
Well, what we know about Ty Cobb's history, that is especially surprising, I suppose. He was known as a cantankerous, and I don't think the word racist is necessarily out of the question in discussing Ty Cobb.
Well, that's kind of been, I think, the popular view. There's also been a pushback on whether that's historically accurate. But let's assume that that all happened. I think he would have done it because he had a lot of respect for the talent that these ball players exhibited head-to-head, because he did encounter them several times and was thrown out stealing at least once by a black catcher.
Well, the one player who is most noteworthy from Detroit Stars history is Norman Turkey Stearns, who's in the Negro Leagues Baseball Hall of Fame. Before I get too far afield, I want to point out that the Negro Leagues Baseball Hall of Fame is in Kansas City, and it's well worth a visit anytime you're in Kansas City. But Turkey Stearns was their most prominent player.
His statistics are amazing. According to the National Negro Hall of Fame, he batted 345 over 19 seasons and hit 175 home runs, which is especially amazing because when we look at this ball field, the dimensions are 515 feet to straightaway center field and 407 feet down the right field line. He was a left-handed hitter.
Oh my gosh, it was a lot friendlier for right-handed hitters. It was only something like 315 down the left field line.
Correct. And so the other thing with Turkey Stearns that I recently learned about is in the 1920s when he was playing for Detroit, he was in the off-season a factory worker. We're not far from the old Dodge main plant, from the current Poletown plant. So you've got a lot of history here and his connection to the auto industry as well as Detroit baseball.
You know, I'm curious about why the grandstands might even still be here. It's no longer in use. The grass is partially mowed where we're standing. Why hasn't this property fallen victim to the wrecking ball in the past? Any idea?
That's a good question. I will simply theorize that because it's off the beaten path, it's not a site where there'd be development potentially. It's just been allowed to exist. And people have come here in the 1980s and 90s to restore the nearby Veterans Memorial Park. And I think by doing that, they kept some life going here, and therefore there wasn't an opportunity or a need to tear this down. Plus, it is quite a construction. It's metal and brick, and so it's fairly substantial. It was a significant investment for the owner back then in the 1920s, 1930s, of somewhere between $100,000 and $200,000. That's a lot of money in that era.
I want to ask about why a Negro Leagues team might have played in Hamtramck. People who aren't old enough to go back to the Depression era, for instance, probably think of Detroit as being largely African American. They think of Hamtramck as being a Polish enclave of the city of Detroit. Do you have any idea why the Stars would have played in Hamtramck rather than somewhere else in the city of Detroit?
I think there are two reasons. One, this site was open and available near the still existing railroad lines. It was able to be rented from the Detroit Lumber Company. So economically for the owner, it made some sense. But then his patrons, where were they coming from? We had Polish that predominated in Hamtramck who would take the streetcars into downtown Detroit and then out to the Rouge factory or the nearby Dodge factory. And we had African Americans who were mainly in the Paradise Valley, Black Bottom area, which is not far from here on the east side of the Detroit metro area. And so they could get here easily. So it made sense for him. This is where people could get to easily using trolleys or whatever other means of transportation were in existence back in the 1920s and 30s.
You know, we talked about Turkey Stearns playing here. A lot of the great visiting players also played at this site, including people like Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson played in games at this location.
Yeah, there were at least a dozen Hall of Famers from different teams that played on this very site as we're standing here. So to think that they did their performances right here, it's sort of makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. Also, one thing that we don't really focus on is the fact that a lot of Hispanic individuals could not break into the major leagues, and so they played in the Negro Leagues, and that's an important part of this story as well. When we look at the Detroit Tigers today and we think of Victor Martinez and Miguel Cabrera and on, and to think that they could not play for the Tigers because of, you know, the policies of Major League Baseball back in the early 20th century, it's kind of staggering to think, but that's what society was about, and this was the way that they were able to come from the Caribbean, come from Mexico, and enjoy playing this game that we all love as Americans.
I want to give people who are interested in visiting some idea of how to find this site, because we parked and walked perhaps a block or so, couldn't really see this site from where we parked. What's your advice to anyone who would like to stop by here?
If they can find Joseph Campo, which is the major route north and south through Hamtramck, and find Veterans Memorial Park towards the south end of Hamtramck, they will be within shouting distance of this site. And they would walk through the park easterly. They'd pass the grave of Colonel John Hamtramck, Revolutionary War veteran. There's a veterans memorial there to soldiers from Hamtramck. Couple of state historical markers for Hamtramck, for the Dodge main plant, the Dodge brothers. Keep going east, you can't miss it. There's a grandstand fenced off with a wide open field where you can imagine that this was a field of dreams for black ball players, for Hispanic ball players, and for anybody who wanted to come watch that talent exhibit itself here on this ground.
Sadly, as far as their dreams could carry them in that era.
Unfortunately, and so maybe by we looking back to history that's not as pleasant as we normally would like to enjoy, it tells us, have we come far? Can we go farther? Should this site also be given a lot more tender, loving care because of its history, its heritage, and an important story that we as Michiganders as Americans have opened up our society over these last decades, and hopefully we can continue to make progress.
Well, I hope people visit Hamtramck to see this and some other historical sites, as you mentioned, that are here in the city.
We should not overlook the food that's available here too, right, Scott?
What are we doing next?
I think we'll go eat somewhere.
Jack Dempsey of the Michigan Historical Commission. We are at Hamtramck Stadium celebrating Negro Leagues baseball history in the Detroit area. Thank you.
Play ball.
Play ball. For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Thanks for joining us for the Thursday edition of Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. An established Michigan environmental organization recently graded the state legislature on its performance in the 2013-2014 session. On its environmental scorecard, the Michigan League of Conservation Voters gave legislators an I, incomplete. In addition to the overall grade, the league rated every Michigan legislator individually after comparing voting records to the organization's stated goals. To learn more about the results and about what state leaders might do to erase that I, Current State welcomes the executive director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters, Lisa Wozniak. Thanks for joining us, Lisa.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
At the top, I want to get your response, though, to the state Senate's action yesterday that would allow wolf hunting in the state to continue. What do you think?
Well, it's a great question. When this issue first emerged, we remained neutral on this issue for a few key reasons. One is that scientific evidence that the species can be managed without threatening the amazing, amazing story that has been the reintroduction and the survival and the growth of the wolf population exists. And number two, the process that has been unfolded around this has been anything but clear and concise. It's been, frankly, quite questionable. Let me be really clear about this, too. I mean, organizationally, we are very supportive of the strong heritage that Michigan has in hunting and fishing. We were a lead organization in the passing of the hunting and fishing license overhaul that took place in this legislative session, and that decision actually puts about 40 new conservation officers on the beat protecting our natural resources, so we were very active in that. Many people on our staff are active hunters or fishermen and women, but it's in the process around this that has been really questionable. And frankly, as I look at the Senate reconvening only once in the month of August and taking this issue up rather than a host of other issues, and the list could be really long, but I will focus on, frankly, the flooding in Detroit as being one of those issues, and the fact that much of that is due to our aging infrastructure there and directly linked also to the sewage overflows that go straight into our waterways. I mean, I think it's very questionable that that was the issue that they needed to address yesterday.
Well, let's revisit some of the considerations that led to that incomplete grade. For one, you lament the fact that a key energy standard is expiring next year and there is no plan to replace it. Is renewable energy on the back burner at the state capitol?
Well, you wouldn't think it would be, given the fact that over the course of the last year, there's been this outstanding collaborative effort underway that it's included Republicans and Democrats alike. It's included faith-based organizations, public health groups. We've been very involved in this. And the result of this activity has been public hearings across the state in the spring of 2013, six of them. Then reports that were issued throughout the fall that indicate that, frankly, our state can and should go to a much higher renewable energy standard. The reports from the Public Service Commission and the Energy Office indicate that we could get to 30% by 2035 and increase our energy efficiency standards by quite a large amount. All of that activity actually resulted in the governor making a statement on this issue in December. So you'd think, frankly, that there would be a lot more attention on this matter, notably because, as you pointed out, our current laws sunset in 2015, which are right around the corner and have brought not only success in these two arenas from investment in renewables, but frankly, it's had an impact on the ratepayers, and it's created jobs. So unfortunately, the legislature doesn't seem to be looking at all those things and taking action.
We are all Michigan utilities are obligated to create 10% of their electricity through renewable sources beginning next year. There are simply more legislators who are content with that standard than those who aren't.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that in this last session, we actually had a very regressive proposal put forth by one legislator to, in fact, roll back the current standard of the 10% goal by 2015. And it wasn't simply and only the public health organizations and the environmental organizations and the organizations that I've listed that said no way to this. But frankly, the utilities also stepped forward and said, you know, this is working for us. We're on everything indicates that we will be completely able to reach that 10% goal by 2015. We've invested in renewables. And in fact, everything says with the dropping costs of wind in particular that it makes good common sense for us to move the state forward in that direction.
Lisa Wozniak is Executive Director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. We're talking about the league's recent environmental scorecard, which gave the Michigan legislature an I for incomplete. Your organization is also pretty vocal on the issue of public land and how much of it the state should have. Right now there's a cap on the amount of public land Michigan can own. What do you feel should happen there and why?
Well, that's also another interesting arena of our focus. As you've pointed out, we've been looking at renewable energy and energy efficiency. We've been looking at public land, and we've also been looking at water protections, notably in a relationship to hydrofracking. But as it pertains to public lands, I mean, there has not only been this arbitrary cap put on the amount of land that the state can own, but frankly, the legislature said that they would go back and remove that cap, which they haven't. The other reason that this issue is of high priority for us is because there's been an unprecedented amount of, frankly, attacks on our public land, attacks that we just have never seen before coming out of our legislature. There have been initiatives put forth to dismantle the very meaning and essence of the Natural Resources Trust Fund and to use those dollars for other purposes. Luckily, none of those have actually been successful, but the public lands protection is one that we find of great importance given the legacy here in the state and, frankly, all of the land conservancies and the land trusts that we find throughout the state that actually represent the communities that they're based in and the incredible value that citizens across the state put in those public lands.
Does this boil down then to a conflict between private ownership and potential development on one side and simply greater acreage assigned to natural space on the other? Is it fair to look at it in that way?
Well, I mean, I think that's the debate that some would like to put forth. But frankly, when we look at the value that we actually have gained through the preservation and protection of these lands, it's directly linked to all of the incredible recreation dollars and the pure Michigan that we so love to promote in this state. And yet the question becomes, are we actually really protecting that in which we're actually marketing and promoting? That dichotomy is something that many like to actually put forth. I actually think it's completely false. I think we can have a robust economy in every part of the state if we actually celebrate and protect those natural resources.
You mentioned fracking just a minute ago. I know that is a significant concern for the Michigan League of Conservation Voters, and that figured into this incomplete grade that you just gave the legislature. How exactly? What are your foremost concerns involving hydrofracking?
You know, we have a long history in Michigan of actually fracking and oil and gas exploration. Our fracking here in the state, the vertical fracking, has gone on for over 50 years. And frankly, the laws on our books in the state of Michigan for that vertical fracking are fairly good. What the question on the table really is pertains to the new horizontal fracking that goes far deeper and far wider and utilizes an extraordinary amount of water and, in turn, additional chemicals. The process involves some highly dangerous chemicals, including a number that have been named carcinogens. And so our look at this is about public disclosure, whether or not the public has the right to know what chemicals are being used in this process. And the new rules that the DEQ has put forth and that there were public hearings on through the end of, and public input through the end of July, basically don't allow for the public to know until after the well is already in process, 30 days after. The other great issue and really important issue, frankly, is the water quality and quantity issues. With millions of gallons of water being used in each well, we've gone from thousands with the vertical fracking to literally millions of gallons with the horizontal. Are our watersheds being protected? Is there an adequate look at the impact of the overall watershed when this water is being pulled from the ground and actually utilized in this fashion, never to be returned? Those are the big questions on the table.
Can horizontal fracturing be done safely? I mean, or are there certain practices that just need to be eliminated?
You know, I think that we can do a lot more to ensure that we put in place strong safeguards for this. I mean, there are some that will say, and we are not among them, that this could never be done safely. I think that there are a number of techniques and tactics and key provisions that we need to put into place to ensure that whatever is done here in Michigan to extract the oil and the gas from our natural resources, the minerals here, that we do it well, and we do it with the greatest regard to what Michigan loves to celebrate and should do so, which is that we are the stewards of 20% of the Earth's fresh surface water. It is our obligation to make sure that this is done as safely as we can possibly make it.
Our guest on Current State, Lisa Wozniak, Executive Director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. So, Lisa, the legislature got an I. I have to ask, was it closer to passing or closer to failing with that I?
It was a true incomplete. I mean, I don't know if you have kids or nieces and nephews, but I mean, and yourself having gone through school, but if you have not completed your job when you're in school, you know, and you have a number of assignments that have not been turned in, you get an incomplete, and it's your job if you want to actually, you know, finish that class, so you have to go back and complete those things. The three key issues that we've been talking about today, the legislature has not taken up. And some of the things that they have taken up, they've taken up, frankly, poorly. We've seen a rollback to our wetlands laws. We've seen a number of things happen that are not at all in the celebratory category for the legislature, in my estimation. We've seen some things actually introduced on the three priorities we've been discussing. But frankly, there's been inactivity. They've not been able or been allowed to pass out of their various committees. And therefore, the legislature has not been able to vote on these issues on the floors of the House and the Senate. So this is a big problem. And most of Michigan citizens don't understand the logjam that's actually happening in our state capital.
In a video on your website, Lisa, you promote the fact that your organization brings Republicans and Democrats together on environmental policy. But the examples in the video are often more local. They're countywide or they're in townships. How do you take those local examples of bipartisan collaboration and make that work better at the state capitol?
You know, I think it's one step at a time. And I think these issues that we're talking about today have unfortunately become more and more divisive when they ought not be. If we think back to Michigan's long and I think very proud heritage in the arena of conservation, we will all see that it has been a bipartisan history. Governor Milliken took responsibility for dealing with the phosphorus issue during his tenure, something that was a very bold and very important act. The legislature during his time and during the decade surrounding that period of time passed some of the most important pieces of legislation that we've had in our state. We had a remarkable law passed at that time that preserved the 30% of our state's most critical dunes. We passed the Michigan Environmental Protection Act, which was a precursor and a role model in large part for what then became the National Environmental Protection Act. These issues do not need to be and ought not be polarizing or partisan. And so we are working at the local level in many places so that we can actually get some good things done, because unfortunately at the legislative level, we have been able to find some areas in which we can actually find common ground. And when we do, as in with the hunting and fishing licenses that were the overhaul that we passed this last session, we celebrate. And we encourage the legislature to continue in that manner. But we often have to go to the local level to actually get some things done. So it's a lot of work, and I think we'll get there, but it's really going to take perseverance.
We're just about out of time. I have to ask you one more example of something else happening environmentally today that you find that you're more encouraged by.
You know, I think I'll go back to some of the local level issues, frankly. In a number of parts of our state, communities are turning what used to be their backs that faced the rivers and their watersheds that run right through some of our major cities and turning to face those rivers. And I'm delighted to say that in Southeast Michigan, whether it's the Detroit River or it's the Huron River, there are amazing initiatives underway to actually celebrate those rivers. And in our second largest city in the state, in Grand Rapids, there's a remarkable conversation taking place about actually renewing and restoring the rapids that the namesake Grand Rapids is all mm-hmm. about, mm-hmm. which would provide for business opportunities, recreational opportunities, and frankly, I think a remarkable celebration of a really amazing river that runs through the state.
Great discussion, Lisa. We want to have you back. Lisa Wozniak is the executive director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters. Many thanks.
Thank you very much.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Catch us every day at noon on AM 870. WKAR AM. Michigan is bursting at the seams. We're one of the most obese states in the nation, with nearly one-third of Michiganians being classified as obese and a whopping 65% who are considered overweight or obese. And with all that extra fat comes substantial costs to society, from rising health care expenses to lost worker productivity to even lower GPAs among young people. A report released just this week by the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, an independent nonpartisan research organization that analyzes public policy questions, takes a deeper look at the obesity problem here in Michigan and wades into the delicate debate about how government can tackle the problem while respecting individual choices. Here with us now to break down the report, Nicole Bradshaw. Nicole's a research associate with the CRC. She joins us as part of Current State's regular monthly check-in with the Citizens Research Council to help us understand important public policy issues in Michigan. Welcome, Nicole.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
What sparked this study exactly?
So over the last several years, CRC has been taking a more active role in healthcare policy. And as part of that, we're taking on topics that are important in the state of Michigan. And obviously, as you said, we have a high rate of obesity. So that was certainly part of it. Last summer, we published a paper that looked at 20 or so healthcare cost drivers in the state. And our plan has been to take a deeper dive into several of these issues. So, for example, last fall, we published a paper on the medical costs related to no-fault auto insurance policy. And later this year, we'll be looking at the primary care physician shortage. And right now, we are clearly looking at obesity and the economic costs and policy options related to this condition.
And talk to us about the costs. We alluded to those, and you focused on cost drivers. What are some of the costs that really rise to the top?
So there are things that we think about that make the most sense. I mean, we know that obesity is a very individualized issue, and that individuals who are obese face issues, health issues. They might see higher medical costs related to any medical treatment they may need. And there's also discrimination in the workplace and in social settings. But the costs related to these to obesity is much more widespread. So back to healthcare spending or medical spending, how does that impact the entire state? Well, we do know that the average healthcare costs for obese individuals is higher than that for healthy weight individuals and even those who are overweight. And the healthcare costs for the severely obese are twice that than healthy weight individuals.
But what drives those costs?
Oh, well, we looked at almost two dozen drivers. And these include things like the policies in schools, such as a lack of strict curricula around physical education, health education. So, for example, health education, physical education must be taught to all grades, but there's no mandated specifications for how long students might spend in those classes. So really, the things that are driving obesity start in childhood, and things like the classroom. Childcare settings as well have limited nutrition standards and almost no physical activity standards, and that impacts a lot of children who have working parents. So even after school, there are situations where there's communities low income and not low-income individuals who have low access to fruits and vegetables. We live in communities that don't have sidewalks. We have jobs that don't require any sort of movement, things like that. So it's really factors that are pervasive throughout the entire community and in our daily lives that have been exacerbated in some ways by technology, despite all the benefits those sorts of things have brought about.
And those factors are more noticeable here in Michigan than they are in other states?
Not really, per se. I didn't look at every single thing that was driving obesity in all the other states. What I tried to look at was all the risk factors in Michigan and how they played a role. So there's some things like...
I guess I'm trying to get an idea why Michigan rated so poorly on this score.
And I agree with you, and that's what we were trying to find out. But there's just not really a clear answer for that. It was difficult to surmise. So one thing that was sort of surprising is physical inactivity. So we know that people gain weight by either eating too much or exercising too little or both. So physical activity, the rates of physical inactivity in Michigan are actually kind of low. We have a little bit higher rates than average of physical activity than the national average. So does that mean that we're okay there and we just need to focus on how much we eat? Possibly. So but do we not take policy actions around physical activity? Probably we still should look at those sorts of things. So what I really wanted to find was, you know, A, B, and C were the clear drivers of higher obesity rates, and therefore we need to, do D, E, and F in order to combat obesity. But it just wasn't a clear-cut issue. But I think your point here is that in order to properly combat this problem, you need to know what's causing it. The solutions need to be relevant to the causes.
Nicole Bradshaw is our guest of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. We're talking about Michigan's obesity problem and what we might do about it. Clarify briefly, if you could, just so we're on the same page. Obesity is what? Overweight is what? Those are two different designations.
You're right. They're not the same thing, and that can be fairly confusing. Obesity is a condition of having too much body fat, and the way this is typically defined is by someone's body mass index, their BMI, which is how we normally hear it. And the BMI is a calculation of height and weight that tries to estimate someone's body fat. So using this calculation, someone who's overweight would have a BMI between 25 and 29.9. Someone who's obese would have a BMI of 30 or greater. And sometimes what is used is a designation for severely obese, which would be a BMI of 35 or greater. And just for reference, a healthy weight individual, male or female, would have a BMI between 18 and 25. Now, these BMIs really only apply to adults because there's different classifications for children that take into consideration differences in body fat based on different stages of growth. In age and gender. So a child would be considered obese if their weight is in the 95th percentile based on their age and their gender.
Now, there's a pretty heated debate over what to do about high obesity rates. This is ongoing. The issue becomes, what role does government play in an issue like obesity that involves so many personal choices? What are the arguments for more government intervention?
So obesity is somewhat unique in that most people are against obesity. It's pretty easy to find a consensus of people who believe that the rates should be lower. So in that sense, everyone's sort of on the same team. But how to go about reducing or preventing obesity is where the debate really arises. On one side, there's groups and policymakers who believe that obesity is a very individual and personalized matter, and that government intervention infringes on the ability that we have as individuals to make personal choices. So, you know, laws might dictate what we can consume, for example, children in schools, nutrition standards, dictating what they can consume, how much they can consume. Some laws limit portion sizes in restaurants. We might be familiar with the law that was that didn't end up going through, but in New York, to try to limit soda sizes that were sold in the city. You know, laws that try to manage how we spend our leisure time. So these sorts of things infringe on personal choices, and some people just don't want to, you know, spend the money toward this issue when we have such limited government resources. But on the other side, we both sort of mentioned earlier that obesity impacts everybody. The obesity is not just a personalized issue. The costs of obesity are spread throughout all of society and borne by nearly everybody who buys health insurance, people who pay taxes, things like that. So that sometimes is justification for government intervention. And then there's other things like market failures. Children just don't have the ability to properly assess the consequences of their food and activity choices. So a lot of times schools will step in and limit access to low nutritious foods, or you know, force children to engage in or, you know, take physical education classes. But I think that people on both sides of this debate agree that policies that create opportunities for people to live healthy lifestyles are a reasonable role for government. So this would be things like increasing the availability of fruit and vegetable access and installing sidewalks in neighborhoods. But regardless of the merits for or against intervention, and just because this is an important public policy issue, the Citizens Research Council really wanted to step in and inform the discussion.
How is the public responding to these prescriptions? Is there a debate going on in the public that you're aware of? And I'm curious, if so, what do you make of it?
So one of the things that I came across were several polls. Specifically, they would look at how people felt about taxes on sodas and junk food. Right now, I'd say that the tide is against taxes on these sort of unhealthy foods and beverages. Polls have shown that. There's been a couple laws in the last 4 years passed, one in Washington and I believe in Maine, that the legislatures passed, and then they were overturned by voters once that taxed sodas. But interestingly, in some of the surveys that I've seen, including one in Michigan, that asked potential voters or registered voters if they would be for something like increased taxes on – or I'm sorry, not increased. We don't have any taxes on sodas. But if they would be willing to support a tax on a soda, a lot of them said no, they wouldn't be. But when asked if they would increase or if they would support a tax on a soda – if the revenues from that tax went toward, you know, childhood obesity issues and fighting and preventing that, then they were more likely to agree with it.
Oh, interesting. Well, going forward, what has to change then for us to improve the do we need to employ some of these governmental interventions? And where is this debate going, do you think?
So one of the interesting things that we found is that Michigan actually has a number of key policies in place that address obesity. So our obesity rate's high, but it's not for a lack of effort on the state or local or school level. All of these levels of government and policymakers have been making efforts over the last several decades in obesity. But one of the things that we point out in our paper is that, for example, many of the state-level policies are voluntary in nature. They are recommendations rather than requirements. So, for example, There's a state law that requires that all schools provide health and physical education to students. But it doesn't provide any further guidance on what that should be. So, for example, there are federal recommendations that say that students should spend at least 150 minutes in PE for elementary, and then middle and high school students should spend 225 minutes per week in physical education, and that at least half that time in class should be spent actually in vigorous or moderate intensity exercise. Michigan, many states do have laws that specify, make these exact specifications, or for example, require recess. Michigan's Board of Education and the Department of Education recommend all these things, but there are no such requirements.
Nicole Bradshaw is a research associate for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, an independent, nonpartisan research organization that analyzes public policy questions. We check in with the CRC on the second Thursday of each month to help us better understand important policy, public policy issues here in Michigan on Current State. Thanks, Nicole, for joining us
today.
Yes,
thank you for having me, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Summer's the time of year when newly minted college graduates are pounding the pavement to grab that first job of their careers, and we will get to that segment in just 1 minute. The American writer and historical fiction master E.L. Doctorow has a new novel out called Andrew's Brain. In it, things are not what they seem. Or are they? Our book contributor Scott Southard has this review.
When your mind often swims in the written words of others, sometimes the water can get a bit muddy. You don't mean for this to happen, but plots might intermingle in your head, characters might meet up even though they are in different stories, and sometimes, honestly, you might point the finger at a possible murderer, not realizing right away that they are from another book, and, of course, perfectly innocent. That is sometimes how my brain works. What gets my brain out of these reading doldrums is something new, something exciting. I love it when a writer challenges himself and me as a reader. And one recent example of this, which I highly recommend to my fellow literary swimmers, is Andrew's Brain by E.L. Doctorow. There are so many different ways you can read this fascinating novel. One way is a very literal interpretation. This book is the transcribed sessions between Andrew and his psychotherapist. Andrew's life is filled with misfortune and dark humor. The story begins with him abandoning his child after the heartbreaking loss of his wife. How she died and why he did this become clear as the story unfolds. Andrew's story is the story of our country over the first decade of this century, with the tragedy of 9/11 and even a surprising and playful appearance by President George Bush. Another way you can interpret this book is that none of this is true, not a single word. These conversations are not in our reality, but are taking place in Andrew's mind, and he is a mental patient, playing with possibilities, influenced by the world and its events. There is not any clear indication that his doctor is even in the room with Andrew, making the book a collection of rants from a very interesting madman. The third way to break down Doctorow's work is my favorite. It is an examination of the creative process, and you are experiencing firsthand the working mind of the novelist, continuously getting inspired by events in the real world, playing with ideas, and then discarding them for others. This interpretation of the novel would explain the almost stream of consciousness vibe to the storytelling and the nitpicking that his doctor sometimes does around Andrew's stories, sounding more like a well-schooled editor than a therapist. Andrew's Brain will challenge you as a reader. It will make you question your perspective on a story and on a character. It might even make you wonder about the understood truth of your own past and what you choose to believe. I finished this book quite a while ago, and my own mind is still haunted by it, still debating its meanings. Yes, this is another kind of muddy literary water to drown in, but a good kind. One that shows again the great potential for literature and how impactful it can be as an art form. Andrew's Brain is a lake worth jumping into. There is something for all brains to swim in. For Current State, this is Scott Southard. We'll be right back.
And Scott Southard is the author of two novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth and the Case of the Dangerous Dare. His writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. It's current state on 90.5 WKAR. Summer's the time of year when newly minted college graduates are pounding the pavement to grab that first job of their careers. One MSU graduate is trampling a much softer surface, the fairway. In about 2 weeks, Yushira Boodrum will compete in the Ladies Pro Golf Qualifying Tournament in Rancho Mirage, California. Boodrum is from India by way of South Africa. She dreams of going pro one day, so you might call the toughest event of her life thus far a job interview. Yushira Boodrum joins us now from Orlando, Florida, to tell us about her international journey into the world of professional golf. Welcome to Current State, Yushira.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
You're just fantastic. It's great to talk to you. How are you feeling about the tryout?
A little nervous, a little apprehensive. This is my first time going over. So, but I'm ready, though. I'm ready. This is what I've dreamed of for a long time. So
how exciting.
I've waited for this moment for a while.
I'm sure. What have you been doing to prepare? How are you preparing for this?
I've just been playing lots and lots, you know, since moving from Lansing. We had a pretty rough winter, so my preparation started pretty late in the year, and then moving down to Orlando. So, I mean, since I've been here, I've just been trying to play every single day, just get competitive again, and just work on my game as much as I can.
And what will the tryouts be like?
It'll be 4 days. It starts on the 26th. Four competitive days of golf, and the top 70 players will make it to the second stage, and then it is one of three stages.
Sounds stressful. Here's a life.
Yeah, no, it's pretty tough. It is pretty tough.
A lifelong dream coming to a head here. A couple of weeks. Tell us a little bit about your background, Yushira. You're from South Africa. When did you move to the United States?
I moved over 4 years ago on a golf scholarship, and I competed at Chattanooga, Tennessee for 2 years, and then I transferred up to Michigan State.
What brought you to East Lansing?
I remember visiting, because when I decided to transfer, I visited a couple schools, and then when I saw what Michigan State had to offer, it was a no-brainer. I mean, in terms athletically, and East Lansing is just a very beautiful place. And from the time I visited, I felt very welcome and very, very at home. So, the facilities, the golf program is unbelievable over there. So, it was a long time coming. I felt very at home over there.
Yushira Boodrum is a recent MSU graduate who will compete in the Ladies Pro Golf Qualifying Tournament in California in just a couple of weeks. She grew up in South Africa. Tell us a little bit more about your time here at MSU. What impacted you the most here at Michigan State?
I just got a very well-rounded experience at Michigan State. I mean, in terms of training and working out, we have amazing trainers that, helped me a lot with my game. The golf program is just unbelievable, and I was part of a very big golf team, so I just had the opportunity to meet a lot of people and compete against basically the best in terms of college golf, is the best college golf out there. So that really helped me with my game too. So I mean, I just felt like my experience is very well rounded, and I going to any other school, I wouldn't have got the same kind of experience. So.
What's the magic about golf, Yushira? What do you love about it the most?
I always say golf is a reflection of life, and it just teaches you so many and allows you to grow in so many more ways. And it's that mental challenge, that constant, psychological challenge on the course where you're constantly pushing yourself. And it's not a game that you could ever master, so there's always something that leaves you coming back for more, and that's what I love about it. I love the challenge. It's a sport where, your competitor is not your biggest challenge. It's yourself, and Yeah, that's why I love it.
Where do you see yourself in a decade? Where would you like to be in 10 years?
Definitely being a pretty strong competitor on the LPGA Tour. That's, like I said, it's been a lifelong dream for me, and I definitely see myself being there and being a really good competitor and just, you always dream of that top 10, you know, on the LPGA or even that number one spot on the LPGA, and that's where I see myself.
How confident are you on a scale of 1 to 10?
I'd give myself about an 8.
That's pretty good.
Right now. Yeah, I've worked towards this for basically my whole life. I've been lucky enough to be able to live my dream, you know, playing college golf here in the United States. So, I think part of it is also believing that you can get there. So, you know, I'd like to say my self-belief is pretty high, so I'm excited.
We wish you the best of luck. Yashira Boudram is a 2014 graduate of Michigan State University, and Yashira is competing in the Ladies Pro Golf Qualifying Tournament in Rancho Mirage, California, beginning August 27th. Best of luck, Yashira. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll be joined by Quatro Sur to continue Current State's Live Music Friday series. Live music here in Studio S. We'll also talk with a Michigan State professor about her recent discoveries involving female job hiring discrimination. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. The executive producer of WKAR's Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also thanks Aaron Young for engineering and Marie Steinbach for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day, and thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.